everyone. Thank you very much for coming today. I'm Leslie Hughes. I'm the co-convener of the Terrestrial Biodiversity Network. And this is Yvette Williams, who is our coordinator. So we'll be kind of introducing the show today. This is the agenda today. So firstly, I'm going to give you just a fairly brief introduction about a number of things. I realise that a lot of you actually already work on climate change, but not all of you do, so I will give a little bit of background about what's been happening climate change-wise in Australia, talk a bit about where how NCAF came to be and how the network fits into the overall NCAF program, and then talk about, just give you one example, this is from North Queensland, from my co-convener's work, Steve Williams, about practical adaptation in conservation of terrestrial biodiversity in the face of climate change, just to kick everything off. Then Yvette will be talking more, a bit more specifically about the network and what you can get out of it. Following that, we'll hand over to Dave and to Kerry to talk about key issues for Tasmania. After morning tea, there'll be some specific talks from specific people about the Tasmanian situation. And then this afternoon will be more of a workshop situation where we'll be talking and gathering things on bits of butcher's paper, as you do in workshops. Okay, so that's this afternoon. We'll come back to that. So firstly, why are we here? We've actually now, this is our last roadshow. We've actually performed one of these in each of the states and territories in Australia. They're really designed to introduce people to thinking about climate change adaptation in the context of biodiversity. We've been getting people in the different states to identify particular priorities for their state. That's what we'll be doing this afternoon for Tasmania. And we're going to be doing a big collation of those because some of the issues for different states are actually quite different, but there's also a lot of commonalities between them. And the real idea of these workshops is to get you to talk to each other, because we've found that even in a small state like Tasmania, people coming together in a workshop like this do meet new people that have interesting things in common. So the outcomes of this that we're aiming at is firstly to raise awareness of NCAF and adaptation research in general, and about what the network you can do for the network and what the network can do for you, and we're always really happy to hear ideas about that sort of thing. The summary of this workshop today will be on the website in a couple of days, as will the presentations be. And as I said, we will be doing a big report collating results across all the networks. Some of you will be aware of the National Adaptation Research Plan for Climate Change and Biodiversity. I was one of the writers of that plan, so we're not going to talk about it in terribly much detail, but by all means ask questions about it if you want to. But we do want to know from you at some stage whether you think there were serious omissions in that plan that we've left out and need to be put into the next updated plan. We'll be talking this afternoon about what are the priorities and challenges, particularly for Tasmania in this space, what research is needed, what the end users really need from the researchers, and how might we overcome any impediments. So to give you just a really brief background about where we're at the moment, as you're all aware, global surface temperature continues to rise. This is looking at temperatures back, thanks Yvette, from 1880 through to about last year. Thank you. Looking at that trend on a shorter timescale from 1980 back to this year, you can see that there's still a very much a rising trend. And if any of the sceptics say to you that it's been cooling since 1998, you can show them this graph and show them that indeed 2009 and 2010 were considerably warmer than 1998. This is the temperature projections for the future produced in the 2007 IPCC Fourth Assessment Report. Many of you will be familiar with this graph. The black line is the temperatures that we've had so far over the last century, and these different coloured lines are the different projections based on the six different special scenarios. When the important thing is that when IPC produced this graph, it didn't assign a particular probability to any one of these scenarios. It said this is the range of possibilities and this is how we've generated those scenarios. Of course, we know quite a bit more since 2007, and we know now that CO2 continues to accelerate in its emissions, up from about 1% per annum to about 3% per annum over the last decade or so. Sea levels are also rising at the top of the IPCC projections because the projections didn't take the melting of West Antarctica into account. So this is where the actual emissions are travelling at the moment, and you can see that it's right at the top, that red line there, the A1, F1 scenario. So we're basically travelling at the most extreme of the IPCC scenarios. And the IPCC has been criticised for lots of things. I think the only justifiable criticism is that it was actually a bit too conservative. Global sea level is also rising right at the uppermost boundary of the IPCC projections, very neatly, in fact. 2005 was actually the warmest year on record in Australia, with about a degree above the long-term average. 2009 was the second warmest year in Australia. 2010 was the equal warmest year globally, but it was actually a little bit cooler in Australia last year than the previous year. And as you can see from this 2005 map, it's really only in that particular year, it was really only in parts of Cape York and the southwest of Western Australia that had below average temperatures. Rainfall's also been changing. This is a trend map going back to 1950. The brown areas indicate drying trends and the green areas indicate wetting trends. And as you can see, virtually all of the west coast and the southwest has been getting drier, and the northwest of the country somewhat wetter. The IPCC identified in the 2007 report natural ecosystems as the most vulnerable of all of the sectors, for a number of reasons, but mainly because natural ecosystems are considered to have less intrinsic adaptive capacity than most of the human sectors. And of course, the scale of the problem for biodiversity, which presumably you care about if you're here, is immense, because it takes about a million or so years for a new species to evolve. The modelling indicates somewhere between 20% and 30% of global species may be at increased risk of extinction at 2 to 3 degrees above pre-industrial levels, and of course we're already at least a third of that way already. We are seeing changes already, and those of you that do field work will probably have seen them. Most people accept the paradigm now that climate change, which hasn't been a big driver of extinction in the last couple of hundred years, will become a much more serious driver of extinction over the next century. And we are already seeing these changes. We are seeing species move towards the poles and upwards in elevation. We're seeing advances in life cycles. We're seeing some evidence of genetic change in a few species, but not very many. We're seeing the proportion of cool-adapted and warm-adapted species within some communities changing. Coral reefs are bleaching, we're getting declining calcification due to the more acid oceans, and we're also seeing the emergence of new diseases. So, what we're all concerned about is what we can do about minimising these impacts. And the obvious thing is that we do need to mitigate and control greenhouse gases, and of course that's been a very big topic in the news lately. What this graph shows is the blue band is if we limit greenhouse gases fairly seriously and keep global temperatures to below 2 degrees above 1990 levels, then we may avoid the more dangerous levels of climate change. The red band is basically the business as usual scenarios, which, you know, frankly, for any of us who have children, doesn't really bear thinking about. So at the lower level, the most optimistic thing that we can aim for With strong mitigation, we may not need to do much adaptation. In the middle, with some mitigation but not enough, adaptation becomes extremely important, though at the upper ends, I think most of us would think that adaptation will actually not do very much if we get up to 6 or 7 degrees above 1990 levels. There's an important question about how much biodiversity can adapt under its own steam without our intervention. Geographic change we are seeing in some species. My personal opinion is that it's not going to be an answer for most species. Most species are simply not mobile enough and not capable of moving quickly enough and finding new habitat in suitable places to cope under their own steam. And the fact that Australia in most parts is very flat, the landscape is extremely fragmented and lots of the habitat is degraded, will also limit the capacity for species to adapt by just moving. A lot of species will have sufficient phenotypic plasticity, including behavioural plasticity, to cope at least for a certain amount of time, and the changes that we're seeing in life cycles is undoubtedly a manifestation of a degree of plasticity. And as I said, there's been a few species showing genetic change, not many studied so far, and in most it's very difficult to tell what's genetic and what's phenotypic plasticity. Put all that together and decide that most species are not actually going to adapt terribly well on their own, and it becomes even more clear that human-mediated adaptation, what we can actually do to help, becomes more and more important. And really, this is sort of the definition of this is the implementation of strategies to enhance the ability of species and communities to cope, to maximise adaptive ability and increase resilience. And I think we can put those strategies in three major buckets. There's a sort of landscape level management, identification and protection of habitat, especially refugia, restoration of habitat. There's the species level strategies like captive breeding and moving species around. And there's the simple, not simple to do, but simple to understand, reduction of other threats to increase the resilience of ecosystems to cope. And that, of course, is where NCAF comes in. NCAF, some of you may be surprised to know, was actually an initiative of the Howard government. The Howard government set aside $50 million over 5 years to create this facility. There was a competitive tendering process, and Griffith University won that tender, so that is where NCAF is based, but there are a number of partner universities with Griffith that help run it. Of the $50 million that NCAF received, $10 million has gone to the networks, $10 million to run the facility, and $30 million was allocated for research under the priorities identified in actually now 9 different national adaptation research plans. The key roles of NCAF include the development of those plans for the major sectors, to identify research gaps, to synthesise existing knowledge and to facilitate its dissemination, to undertake a program of integrative research, and to establish the networks. There are 8 networks. We're here for the terrestrial one, but some of you may also be members of the other networks. There's water resources and freshwater biodiversity, marine biodiversity. I thought it was rather good that biodiversity actually appears in the name of 3 of the 8 networks. Primary industries, health, emergency management, settlements and infrastructure, and social, economic and institutional dimensions. The networks have 4 main roles: to facilitate the sharing of information and resources, to synthesise existing research, to contribute to those national adaptation research plans, and most importantly, I think, to nurture young researchers and build the careers of up-and-coming investigators and research students. Our own network has this as our goal: to provide decision makers with information to develop and implement strategies to promote adaptation to climate change in terrestrial ecosystems. Steve Williams from James Cook and I convene it. We have a steering committee with members from each of the states, including Tasmania, where Dave Bowman and Kerry Bridle are our steering committee members here. It's a very distributed network. We try to distribute activity and resources right throughout the country in all of the states. This is our structure. We have a steering committee, as I said, network participants. I think we're at over 1,100 members now. The Terrestrial Biodiversity Network is actually the largest network in terms of membership. And we have a number of other links. If you can't read those down the back, don't worry about them. So I think I've dealt with our goals already. What I want to do just to finish off now is to show you an example. It's not my own research, it's Steve Williams' research, because I think his research group is, I think, one of the most advanced in terms of creating a database to underscore adaptation research in Australia. So Steve and his group work up in the wet tropics of northern Australia, up around Cairns in the World Heritage Area. It's one of the most, if not the most, biologically rich area in Australia in terms of endemism and species diversity, at least terrestrially speaking. It's an area of about 10,000 square kilometres of tropical rainforest. Not quite sure how long these pictures go for. I think that's it. I always feel funny talking about somebody else's research, especially when a vet's here to keep me honest. Steve and his group have been doing for many years transects up elevation from coast to the highest peaks, right up the length of the World Heritage Area. They've done elevational sampling at 200 metre intervals for many taxa, including birds, reptiles, frogs, and invertebrates. So they've got probably a database that is probably second to none, I think, in Australia. Using that database, they've been doing species distribution modelling to get a handle on what might happen to species richness in the area as the climate warms up. So if you watch that little thermometer there, that will show the degrees of warming. And these three scenarios indicate the worst, the average, and the best scenario in terms of future climate change. And the colours indicate changes in species richness. So if we put the temperatures up, you'll see lots of species drop out, until if we get to 6 degrees, it's only in the most optimistic scenario that we've really got very many species left at all. So the wet tropics is basically considered to be extremely vulnerable to climate change. So at about a 3 degree warming, only about 35% of species that for which there is data so far are considered relatively safe, about 30% extinct, and the rest of them endangered. So in these regions, about 84% of the species that they've been working on have been identified as relying on upland cool refugia for at least part of their life cycles. So what adaptation actions can be taken to protect this sort of system? And this is what they've been working on. So firstly, they've been doing research to try to understand where these cool refugia are, how large they have to be effective, what species will benefit from them, what factors might threaten those refugia, and how to better manage them. So here's an example of the sort of GIS work that they've been doing to help understand what to do in the future. So firstly, I think those blue areas there are the identified cool refugia for the future based on all of the modelling. And then they've identified various adaptation options. So the first one is to Sorry, I'm getting a bit confused because it's not actually mine. They're the refugia there that they've identified. Here are the adaptation options. So there's some of the refugia that are already in protected areas. So in that case, what you would do is manage the other stresses like weeds and feral animals. But then there's also the potential for those sites to be suitable sites for translocation of other species into them that might become more threatened elsewhere. And then there's some refugia that they consider high value that are not currently within a protected area but should be. So that's where you might identify areas for land acquisition, off-reserve management agreements and corridors. Then there are areas of degraded landscape that potentially could be restored and become high-value refugia in the future with various habitat restoration programs. Okay, so that just gives you a little snapshot of the sorts of adaptation research that's going on in other parts of the country and where it might end up. Finally, I just want to show you some of the output from one of the workshops that we've run. We've been doing about 2 workshops a year on specific topics around the country. The first one, which was now about 18 months ago, was on conservation planning and climate change that took place up in North Queensland. And a number of papers, you don't have to worry about the details of this, a number of papers have been produced from that workshop about adapting terrestrial biodiversity to climate change, including the production of these sorts of decision trees for adaptation management. Okay, like that. That's just an example. Okay, I'm going to leave it there, hand over to Yvette now to talk a bit more about the network itself.